Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Road. Sunday the 2nd of April. The weather is firmly in April showers mode, as you probably know, Kev, having spent part of your week in London. Miserable. Miserable week.
Yeah, we had 2 days that was miserable, wasn't it? Tuesday and Wednesday was pretty miserable. You say April showers, but I mean, I never saw the sky once in the 2 days that was there because it was just blanket clouds. Weather changeable. I'm back to Egypt and weather completely changeable. It's sun and then it's sun and then it's sun. It's going to be early 30s this week. So summer is beginning.
Final show of the season before we take a well-earned break from the market. So, we'll be back in sort of 3 or 4 weeks, probably coincide roughly with our trip to the US to see Ben's Creek. So watch this space on that one. First one was the bit of news this week was former US President Donald Trump has been indicted in criminal proceedings for the first time in US history. While a specific charge is not yet known, the grand jury investigation centered around a $130,000 bribe paid to porn actress Stormy Daniels to keep her from going public about a sexual encounter with Trump. Trump is due to appear in court next week, and supporters have already gathered outside his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, where he has been staying. While Trump described the indictment as political persecution, Democrats say it proves that no one is above the law. What are your thoughts on that one?
Well, the irony of ironies is that what he did, as in his behavior and then paying $130,000, is not what he will be indicted for. He will be indicted for the fact that he tried to play it off as a business expense. So he basically tried to avoid paying tax or using his after-tax income. And I think that's what they're going to get him on. So it's like a sucker punch. It's like,
yeah, I think there are two parts, but the mere fact that he's paid hush money, and it was for many, many years ago, wasn't it? Was it something like 2006 before he was president? Not that it matters, but it ultimately, these are charges and it's bribery.
No, I think it's the charge for doing that isn't there. It doesn't exist. What he did was not wrong. He paid some in under U.S. law. I think, anyway, he paid some, what I read. Was paying someone is fine if they want to accept that, but especially if it's done under an agreement, but you then use that money and offset it against business expenses. This is a felony. So, yeah, it's bizarre. It is political persecution as well, because there's no way that if he wasn't who he is, that they would go after him for something like this. So, yeah, they've just tried to dig up anything and they finally found something. But, I mean, back to the real world. There's people struggling to survive all over the world. There's food shortages. There's currency problems in many, many countries. And it's not looking good. So there's many first world problems, but third world's struggling.
Did you see King Charles? It's hard to get used to that one, isn't it? Sort of getting your head around that one months after. He did a speech in German as he visited, didn't he, this week. There was quite a lot of anti-German jibes, or they can come to an end now. But basically, he's celebrating, you know, obviously the ancestry as well. So I think he just wants to move and improve his relationship or relations with Germany. I don't know if you saw that visit, but he did quite a monumental speech in German.
Well, what's the connection? Was it Queen Victoria was German, or she married a German husband or something like that? I mean, but basically the royal family is descendants of Germany.
Yeah, it was basically, he would have been a Saxe-Coburg-Gotha if his great-grandfather, George V, hadn't changed the royal surname during the First World War, thanks to embarrassment over the German name bequeathed to the royal family by Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband.
Yep, there you go. So, yeah, nothing stranger than the truth sometimes. Hey?
Exactly. And then there was also the news of the UK housing market experiencing its fastest annual decline in house prices in 14 years, according to the latest figures from the Nationwide. The lender reported a 3.1% drop in house prices compared to the previous year, with a slowdown across all regions of the country. While this decline may be welcomed by first-time buyers, it also means that renting has become more expensive for many people, and obviously mortgage rates are higher than they may have planned for. The Nationwide's findings echo the general conclusion of the other house price surveys and commentary, which show a slowdown in the sector and falling prices.
Shock horror.
Shock horror, exactly.
It's not a big surprise, is it really? I mean, having visited London at the same time, the shops are not that busy, and I'm sure that's duplicated across the high streets of the UK. People aren't spending huge amounts on non-discretionary things. So in other words, you know, luxuries and all that sort of stuff are probably not going to be bought by the normal people, if you like. Maybe it doesn't affect the rich, but it's going to continue to have impacts and ripples. That said, I do think, and I've said it before, and I've been wrong every time so far, but you never know. A clock is right twice a day by the sounds of things. I do think that sometime, some stage this year, and it could be sooner rather than later, that, you know, the bear market comes to an end and we start to level off and go into the very beginnings of a bull market again. And definitely, in my view, in the small cap arena, because the small cap arena is so beaten down and so undervalued in so many different stocks that I can't see that it won't respond, and it will respond big when it responds, I'm sure.
So another interesting article this week was about EVs. Over 300 million electric vehicles are expected to be on the world's roads by 2030, according to the International Energy Agency. However, the American EV market is still small. In 2021, the US accounted for less than 10% of new global EV registrations, while China and Europe accounted for 50% and 35%, respectively. China also accounts for over 70% of global EV battery production capacity, meaning the US is heavily dependent on imports and battery metals. I don't know if you saw the news this week, Kev, that the North America's largest electric vehicle battery recycling facility has opened in East Georgia. It's a 150,000 square foot facility owned by Massachusetts-based Ascend Elements, and it can process 30,000 tons of used lithium-ion batteries and manufacturing scrap per year, equivalent to 70,000 electric vehicle batteries. The CEO, Michael Cronley, said the facility is critical infrastructure that is needed to support the energy transition as millions of EVs take to the roads. The facility is expected to bring 185 jobs to the area and will recycle up to 98% of battery materials that would otherwise end up in landfill. And there was also news of the management company Cerber Solutions investing over $300 million in a lithium-ion EV battery recycling facility in South Carolina, where operations are expected to start in late 2024. If only we had a potential solution in the UK, Kev.
Well, yeah, it sounds like we need one or many more in the UK. So do you know anybody?
You know a company of mine? Well, we're joined this week by Technology Minerals, Alex Danbury, Robin Rundle and Lester Kemp. Welcome, gents. It's been a busy week for you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Where do we start, Alex, this week? I mean, because there's been quite a lot of news flow coming out. You've obviously had the news of the high net worth individual investing a significant sum into the company, which is obviously a very much a vote of confidence. And then you have the recent news, basically awarding of the $1.96 million grant. Do you want to start with that news?
Yeah, absolutely. We received £2.5 million as an investment from a high net worth. 800 grand came in at a penny, locked in for 12 months. And then 1.7 as a convertible loan note with a 12% coupon, convertible for 2 years at 3.5p. So yes, as you say, a really nice vote of confidence from that individual who sees that we're heavily undervalued. And then to round off the week, we got a grant from Innovate UK for £1.96 million for a mobile shredding unit, which I'll let Robin tell you about.
Just before we start, because this company, not really that complicated, but I want people to understand the different businesses and the different revenue streams possible within Technology Minerals. So first of all, imagine yourself a circle. You got four quadrants within that circle. First quadrant is going to be an old established business in the UK and around the world, which is lead acid batteries. Okay, so we will talk about that as one segment of this business. The second part would be the lithium ion batteries. The ability to transport the lithium-ion batteries back to the plants using the boxes that have been designed. And then the third section would then be the grants that were given yesterday. And that basically allows them to go out and process the lithium-ion batteries on site or wherever they pick the batteries up. And then the fourth segment is the mining assets that Technology Mineral owns. And again, Why you always hear Robin Brundle bleating on about circular economy, okay? Sorry about that, Rob. It's because the mining assets are all in the battery area as well. So these are the four areas, and we're going to discuss each one sort of one by one.
I think Robin talks about it as a sausage machine, if in fact.
Okay, yes. Well, circular economy, sausage machines. Still, the sausages are quite circular as well, aren't they? Depending on how you put them. So as you wish. But let's move to Robin now to answer that question. And the question is, yes, how is the grant going to fit into the whole lithium iron battery recycling situation?
Okay, so thanks for that segue there, Kevin. And you know, it's slightly more significant than sausages, you'll be pleased to know. Yeah, it's actually really important, because if you actually take from a strategic point of view, the key actions and messages from the COP26, the COP27, and what appears to be the agenda for COP28 at the end of this year in the Middle East, you know, there is going to be an awful lot more producer responsibility. And there's also going to be a big push for legislation to help the consumer be more responsible with recycling their waste effectively. And we think that one of those solutions will be a safe and an effective doorstep collection process. And so with our technical team, we've looked at downscaling a full-scale plant at Wolverhampton so that we can actually, if you like, in simplistic terms, fit it onto an existing dustbin lorry that we would all know as a big dustbin lorry that collects your black bin and green bin and so on from the pavement outside your house. So we've come up with a safe solution. And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, it's all well and good saying, well, you know, if we all just separated our electric toothbrushes, our mobile phones and so on, and let the council pick them up. But then you've actually technically got a mobile bomb solution going there and a major health risk. So we've gone one stage further than that, because we want it to be safe at the point of collection. So if you can imagine that this lorry comes along in the normal way of any dustbin lorry, it has an arm that picks up your whatever color box it ends up being. Let's, for ease, call it a purple box. And it picks up the purple box. It tips whatever you've got in there into our lorry, and instantly it goes into our safe system that you've all seen at the Wolverhampton site, that's in the back of the lorry effectively. And it actually processes and separates there and then, so that all of the same offtake streams that we've got from the big industrial plant are actually taking place inside the lorry. So as it's moving along, they've all been neutralized effectively and in a safe environment. And of course, what we have to be aware of and we're comfortable with is that, you know, as humans, we sometimes get it wrong. So we're expecting there to be dirty nappies and, you know, the odd kettle or whatever it is that suddenly makes its way into this bin by mistake. And of course, we're confident that the lorry will actually manage to process that.
Robin, that would become a dirty bomb then, not just a
touche. Yes, it would. But I think it's important to know that the process will do that. Now, clearly, if we've got dirty nappies mixed in the black mass that comes out of the back end, that's going to have a knock-on effect to values and to processes. So there's commercial decisions to be considered. But primarily, we believe this is a very early to market opportunity for us. And of course, it is something that can be rolled out outside of the UK on an international basis. And the holy grail for us would be to have it on an electric platform with a little range extender, such as a hydrogen fuel cell extender, so that these lorries that are doing what's described as milk rounds, local milk rounds, could actually go further afield. That leads to the second use. So with the lorry, you know, if we've got automotive companies, car dealerships, insurance companies, anybody in that sector that suddenly has a series of electric thermal reaction going on site, we can actually use the lorry concept into being a mobile instant solution. So we take the solution to the problem, and therefore we can shred safely on site of a car manufacturing plant or a car dealership in the middle of the inner city. If they've had a problem, we can go and actually deal with take the solution to the problem.
That is one section where we're going to take, as you put it, the solution to the problem. So let's talk now about bringing the problem back to the solution, which is this lithium ion battery plant, and, or should I say plants. So tell us, yes, what's hopefully going to happen. And I mean, there's been a lot of frustration in how long we've had to wait for the environmental agencies. But I think, you know, hopefully we're very close. But this is only stage one of maybe 5-10 steps to have more of these in the UK and Europe and, yes, wherever. Maybe, I mean, by the sounds of things, Asia, China, and all of these places desperately need these as well. So tell us your thoughts on this.
Okay, so yeah, you're quite right, Kevin. We've got our automated and industrial scale plant ready to go. As you know, we have ongoing dialogues with the licensing authority. And as a result of the progress that we've made in that, we have kicked off the final expenditure. With the new investment that we've recently received, we now have the confidence and the money to put things like fire prevention, which is, you know, is an expensive thing to do in a factory site. And we wanted to do it once and once only for obvious commercial reasons. And so we're now scaling up in readiness, which is very exciting. You know, the team are even more enthusiastic to see such forward steps as these. And so it's a great place to be right now. And yes, you know, from a scaling up point of view, we've already spoken previously about the fact that our business model is to have these plants as modules, cost-effective modules that will work for gigafactories, that will work for automotive car companies that are making their own batteries, where we can cohabit with them in their own factory environment and actually either operate or sell them our plant. And of course, we have then the second scenario where we're running our own business from Wolverhampton, where we're doing a national collection system to bring the batteries to the Wolverhampton site to safely process them. You know, when you look at the UK historically, there really are two clear business paths. One is to build one really heavy invested site, like you see up in Teesside, and as one example, that's at risk. You know, it's huge investment to build just one plant and have a hub and spoke system, if you like, that draws the materials from all around the UK. Or you do the route that we've gone and said, look, let's make it a more affordable modular concept so that the modules can be added to suit demand. And therefore, the commercial viability is better assured at that smaller scale than it is by putting a £200 million plant that could be redundant and die commercially in, you know, 2 years' time, say. So that is our route to market. And as a result, and with a lot of the USPs that we've previously outlined with our process, we have significant interest from all of those sectors that will enable us to choose carefully business partners where we wish to sell them product, where we will maintain a service contract with them, of course. And we've got that opportunity to sell or to lease. You know, we're not precious about that. And, but we've got control because we've got control of the IP on the plant and we've got control of the IP on the process. If we feel that there are, you know, areas that are considered not friendly to the UK, then we would certainly not wish to be seen to taking our British product into those areas. Mm. So for us, it's, you know, that's a very wide description I've given you there, Kevin, but you know, hopefully that gives you a little bit better clarity as to some of the thinking that we've got going on in the background.
I suppose by going small, as you've mentioned, or smaller than the, I think it was the Altilium Metals, the one that you alluded to up in Teesside, which announced their plans for, I think it's to generate recycled battery waste from about 150,000 electric vehicles. But by doing the smaller scale and IP, will that give you first mover advantage?
Yes, it will, Phil. And let me just explain how we think it will. We're ready to go, first of all. And when you listen to a lot of other rhetoric, it's very future tense from our potential competitors, effectively. The other element I'd ask you to look at is look at their percentage of claims around how much they're going to be able to recycle. Because one of the USPs we have is that we have a completely dry front-end process that enables us to extract the electrolyte. And that is around 2% content of the battery. So when you see their claims, if there's a significant shortage, it's because they're using a different front-end process that means that they can't reclaim that electrolyte. So I could go into a lot of detail that would probably have you asleep at your desk. So I won't bore you with that unless you want to hear it. But certainly, yes, we've got that first mover and advantage. And what the automotive OEMs and the gigafactories are telling us is that, you know, in their first year of switching on their plant, it takes them quite a while to get their efficiencies and their product fine-tuned on the production line. And therefore, let's just take it in years as an example. In year one, say, they may need around three of our plant to cater with their, between 80 and 90% factory scrap until they fine-tune and hone their processes. Keep it simple. In year two, they get down to industry standards of around 9 or 10% factory scrap. So what they could do is in year one have three of our plant, and then in year two, they may be down to one of our plants working 24/7 alongside their factory production, and therefore they can redeploy the other two, giving them back space, giving them back energy, CO2, and the carbon footprint scenario. And actually, that's the beauty, and that's what that's the feedback that we're getting as to why this modular concept is actually of great interest to them.
Sure. So here you are. So you've got, imagine sort of months down the line, hopefully the lithium ion plant is online, and you want to look at the demographics of Europe and even the rest of the world. We know Spain or somewhere like that, potentially take Spain as an example, something like the eighth largest car producer in the world, second largest in Europe. You've got big manufacturers, Volkswagen, Renault, Nissan, Ford, Seat, Cupra, all manufacturing. How easy would it be to take the concept and move it into mainland Europe?
At the drop of a hat, basically. And as you would expect, we are already in some of those discussions that you mentioned there. So, we even designed the plant to be, has skids underneath it effectively. So, where we're looking at places like the USA for rollout, we're the potential, partners, let's say, because we're a relatively small team. So we will need to partner with people to accelerate those rollouts.
Yeah,
people on the ground doing some doing, basically. And we're on skids, and we can fit the whole process into 5 40-foot seagoing containers. So that gives you some idea of, again, we've put thought to that element of it. But of course, as again we've explained in your previous podcasts, that the real thing here is our front end piece of plant and kit.
Sure.
Which is where our IP sits. Everything else behind that is standard recycling plant that can be purchased anywhere around the world. So in essence, when we're having these discussions, what we actually have is a situation where we will be selling our front-end plant, and we will then be giving a specification for those people in the countries that we're going to be selling to actually source locally, so that we're not shipping heavy plant around the world and trying to be responsible from an ESG point of view, where they can actually go off and buy to the specification in their local market. And then we obviously, if you like, provide the drawings on, and we will send our engineers to support the connecting of all of those pieces as well. So, there's a lot of thought gone into this modular concept.
So, Robin, fantastic idea. Quite obvious the world needs it. The Environmental Agency obviously doesn't think there's a rush, but such is life. What are the financial parameters around them? I understand that people are actually going to have to pay you to take the lithium-ion batteries, which is obviously a different scenario than the lead acid. And what sort of amount of production can we expect? And how much does this black mass sell for? Is it volatile, etc.? So there are lots of questions there, but I know you're able to answer them.
Thank you. I'll try and take them in as much of a logical answer as I can. So the UK business model that we have is that, yes, we are a solution provider. So therefore, depending on the chemistry of the battery, because as you know, we can take all five of the key chemistries for lithium ion, it depends on the value that we get from a front end gate fee, and you know that can vary from you know around the £1,500 to around the £4,500 per ton, depending on the chemistry and the content of the material within it. On the output side, once it's been through, so our plant on a single shift, so an 8-hour shift, 5 days a week, we'll be able to process 8,300 tons of feedstock. And that's going to generate just short of 5,000 tons of black mass. Black mass, and you know, you remember we separate off plastics and paper and ferrous, non-ferrous, but we end up, and they're commodities that we sell along with the electrolyte. So they're commodities that all have a revenue stream to them. But the key value is where everybody's focused is on this black mass, as it's described, the four key metals or key salts as they actually are. And because they're commodities that will be traded on the commodities market, the price of that you know is fundamentally determined where the market goes. So in our initial business plan, to give you some idea, we had black mass in at around £3,500 per ton. But the way that the commodity prices have gone, that has now risen to between £5,000 and £6,000 per ton as a value as we sit today. So yes, you know, it does fluctuate with the markets, of course. You would expect it to, but at the moment, you know, we don't see any short-term reason for those commodities to go backwards. And to back to Phil's earlier point at the head of this, you know, when you look at the push for the transition to electric transport in the automotive space, you know, the UK government, for example, have now set really robust targets on the percentage of EVs that need to be sold here in the UK. I use the word sold very loosely because often in the auto space, if targets like this have to be hit, if there isn't a natural market, then cars can get registered by the car company and then sold as second-hand cars. So, you know, we have to just make sure that as we review consumer demand on this, that they are genuinely cars that are going to end users. Sorry, a bit of a diversion there, but I just thought I'd throw that one in for you.
I think we'll bring Lester in. Lester's sat very patiently there and, you know, in the background. So, Lester, obviously we met down at Indaba and it was great to see you. How do you feel the show? And obviously you were also at the PDAC show. Do you want to just give the listeners a feel for how the sort of mining world is and the buzz around things like the recycling space, EV metals, etc.?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for hosting me at Indaba. It was a great function in the evening. Really, really enjoyed it.
Wasn't quite enough food, was there?
Good food and good wine and good company. So very much enjoyed it. Thank you. Yeah, there was quite a good buzz around Indaba. A lot of interest in the battery metal space. And as you probably know, we had our first booth at PDAC earlier this month. Oh, sorry, in March. And that was very, very successful. We were quite smart. We actually brought a 20 kilo lump of spodumene from Ireland, put that on our table, and that attracted a lot of traffic. So we had one of the largest lithium companies in the world visiting us and stroking the sample and wanting to have their pictures taken. So it was quite amusing. But the PDAC has led to a lot of interest. We're in very early stage discussions with parties who are interested in, you know, potentially doing a joint venture or whatever with us, and site visits. But like I say, it's an early stage, but very, very exciting. And I think the PDAC was definitely worth attending and having a booth there because we had a huge amount of footfall. So all very encouraging. And I think, you know, there's probably some good news to come in the next couple of months related to that.
Very good. I mean, are you always sort of keeping your eyes open for new assets or, look, you know, looking for new projects all around the world as you travel?
Yes, very much so. I'd been down to one location yesterday looking at some opportunities, but I've got a very extensive network of contacts, and I also tend to have a look on LinkedIn quite a lot. And we do spot opportunities, and we do go through a process of reviewing them and seeing whether they might fit into our portfolio. But as you know, our model really is a project generator. So we acquire early stage projects which we think have value, and we spend a bit of our money on them to take them up the value curve and hopefully get into a position where the work that we've done attracts a larger company, a major, and take on the bigger spend moving forward. We're not miners at the end of the day, we're explorers, but we do a project generation. And I think that's proving quite successful.
Yeah. Are you finding that there's a mix between the vehicle manufacturers there at these trade shows as well as large mining companies?
Yeah, you are getting the presence of the vehicle manufacturers coming to the mining sites, mining conferences. One of our parties, partners has been approached by, one of the major EV car manufacturers and signed a confidentiality agreement. So we are seeing them creep down the line towards the producers and the explorers, which I think is great because there is a discord between what we do as explorers and the actual, end product users. And it would be, the junior mining space is tough. It's tough to raise capital. But if the OEMs are thinking outside the box and start investing further down the line, I think that's very beneficial to us. And the more that happens, the better, really.
Very good. Lester, just give us a quick overview of all the assets, what stages that they're at, and how many billions they're going to be worth when you finally get them sorted out.
So we've got two licenses in the Idaho Cobalt Belt, which is a very famous belt, geological belt within America, where you can actually mine cobalt as a primary metal. So we've got about 16,000 acres there. We've got some very exciting ground in Ireland for lithium, and one of our joint venture partners put out a press release, as we did late last month, to advise that they're going to start drilling on the property very, very shortly. And that drilling should take place probably around the end of this month. So we'll have some drill results from our property in Ireland, which should be very exciting. We also have a project in northern Spain where we've got 7 licenses, 6 under application still, but one has been granted over 3 years ago, and that's for nickel, copper, and cobalt. We've reached the stage now where we've done sufficient work, and the next step really is drilling. But like I say, following the PDAC, we have had interest from other parties to potentially do a deal with us to cover the drilling. But whether that happens or not, we don't know. It's at an early stage. And then we also have 5 licenses in Cameroon for cobalt-rich, copper-rich, nickel-rich laterite. And we currently have a team in country who are putting out the beacons and marking out the licenses, engaging with all the villagers who fall within our license area, and also taking samples at the same time as they're out in the field. So those are the 4 main sort of key areas. So USA, Ireland, Northern Spain, and Cameroon.
I know it's a bit like choosing a favorite child, but which one would you choose?
I like Ireland. The fact that we're getting stunning grades, spodumene, up to 3.75% dilithium oxide, that we're finding these very large float samples, up to a tonne or more in weight, in at the edge of these filled boundaries and in the dry stone walls. I should say we're not going to be mining the dry stone walls, but that's where we find these float material.
Which all the Irish farmers going, come on!
That was the reaction we had, that on some social media they assumed that we'd take all the dry stone walls out of Ireland and would just be one big green field. So I can assure everybody that's not going to happen. But what it does show is that we're getting these really large flakes of almost solid spodumene. So it shows there is a very proximal source, and we know that although the area is covered by glacial till, in some places, it's only 30 centimeters deep. So I'm really excited. We've got a drill program planned by a joint venture partner at the end of this month, and they're going to put in 10 drill holes targeting 5 potential pegmatite zones within southern license called PLA 1597, which we also call Nokeen. So that is my favorite. I really, really am excited. I can't wait till the rigs land on site and start drilling.
Sorry, whereabouts in Ireland is it again?
It's in southern Ireland, towards the southwest.
County Wicklow direction?
County Wicklow. County Wicklow.
Ah, okay. Very good. From the point of view of the company, the whole point is to get joint venture partners into each one of these deals, and they will take the capex off your hands, and then you will benefit. In what way do you expect? You will benefit in terms of a sort of a net smelter type scenario, or a percentage of the revenue, or how would it work, do you think?
Yeah, look, there's various ways of skinning a cat. Sometimes you get deals where the major will come in and do a certain amount of work as far as the feasibility study, or they'll earn up to sort of 80% of the project. At that stage, you have the opportunity to fund pro rata. So, if we think that the project you know, is fantastic. Our joint venture partner thinks as well. Then it gives us the ability to raise capital and maintain our position in that project. Otherwise, if we decide not to, then we would probably be diluted down to a royalty and just allow the major to go in and mine. And, you know, we take the paycheck at the end of each month when the concentrate is sold.
Okay, very good. So that's three segments. Now we move on, and I'll come back to you, Alex, about the fourth segment, which is the lead acid batteries. So tell us just a brief history and, you know, how's the economics of these plants going to work in terms of the size that you have of the plant that we saw there in Birmingham?
Sure. Well, the lead acid battery industry is age old, and they've been recycled for a long time as well, but just not in a very clean way. They often just get chucked block stock into smelters, or they get fly tipped, but there's value in the lead. So more and more they do get sold, but as I said, it's the way they're processed isn't very clean. So what we're doing there is simply cleaning up an age old industry. And we have a site built just outside Birmingham in a place called Tipton, that can process 16,000 tons a year, and we have to buy the feedstock there because, as I said, there's value. But we, as lead is linked to the LME, we keep a stable margin. What we pay on the front end will vary the same as what we sell on the back end. So we are selling a cleaned up product by selling out plastics, neutralizing the battery acid, and then getting a lead paste, which we sell out to smelters, which they can turn into ingot. At the moment, we are awaiting the variation on our EA license there. As the site we took over originally had a permit for lead, so we are currently able to hand process batteries on site, but we can't put them through the big machine. But it does mean we can start to generate some cash flow. We expect that variation to come through within the next 8 weeks or so, but I think the Wolverhampton site is a priority for us on that front. Yeah, we have a nice business that creates solid margin, about 30% margin going forward. And there's certainly a lot of batteries in this country and globally. And even with the increase of EVs on the road, each EV has a lead acid battery in it as well. So that industry is going nowhere in terms of, you know, it's not disappearing. So we'll look to roll those out as well. It's a nice business that then it'll generate good cash flow. The real excitement for us lies in lithium ion.
My final question, which is really, how do you see, and I mean, I suppose maybe it's a hard question to ask because we've been waiting for this first one to happen, but I'm assuming that once the first one's happen, it's not going to quite be a sausage machine, but it's going to be much easier to go through the environmental process the next time. What is the plan for the next sort of 3 years, 4 years, 5 years for Technology Minerals in this space?
Okay. Thanks, Kevin, for that. So you'll know that for the UK, the business plan has been to roll out five of each of the chemistries. So in other words, sort of 10 or more, in fact, if the demand is there, to cover the compass points of the UK. And the business model is predicated on one of each chemistry each year. So one lithium ion plant, one lead acid plant each year. And the idea, as we said earlier, is to get the compass points to keep logistics down and therefore carbon footprint down of moving the materials to be recycled. And again, as we've alluded to, we are in discussions to look at how we roll out into the USA, how we roll out into Europe. There's clearly interest from Asia and also the Middle East, but as again, you know, we're a relatively small team, so we're making sure that we're not trying to overreach and go too far too fast on that. And you know, with mobile solutions, again, you know, there will be interest from a number of sectors, including governments and councils, for that type of product, as well as from commerce, anybody that's producing goods with lithium ion batteries in. So yeah, we've got an awful lot of commercial activity going on, and we will also as soon as we go live, we've got a number of we've got a number of major corporations that will advance discussions around purchasing stroke leasing, you know, some new lithium ion processing plants for their own use effectively. So lots of good commercials coming on for us. I think once we're up and running, the rollout
is going to be something that we're going to have to rein in to some extent rather than push. And certainly, you know, with things like front-end feedstock, there is evident that there is a global build-up, as you described earlier, of these batteries sitting in containers and warehouses and so on, just waiting to be processed. So, you know, we're confident that the front-end feedstock's there. We're confident we can process and we have a rollout strategy, and we have a number of people interested in bidding for each of the one-ton bags of black mass that we will be getting as off-taker. And, you know, we are cutting edge. You know, the legislation around what we're doing, we've got government agencies that are wanting to work hand in glove with us so that we can cookie cutter this, to use an expression, to make sure that, you know, future plants with a lithium ion are now a glide path rather than a struggle, frankly. Because, you know, the agencies, the various agencies are now far more familiar with the processes, with the work that we've done. So, you know, and of course, we will be looking and working with people like SEPA, who are the Scottish equivalent of the Environmental Agency here in the UK. And, you know, they've looked at our processes as well. And it's something that Scotland would welcome just as a, you know, a nearby local rollout situation. So, a lot going on in the background, Kevin. You know, we're doing the 16-hour days and often 6 days a week. Perhaps if I'd have been 30 years younger, it might have been 7 days a week, so I apologise for that. I do need to have a day off, I'm afraid, each week, but certainly the whole
time. You told me this week you were 22, Robin Brunner.
Yeah, I think those days are long gone, my friend. They're long gone. It's just a really exciting space to be in, you know. It doesn't matter whether we're talking to investors. It doesn't matter if we're talking to OEMs. Everybody's really enthusiastic about this space. And do you know what? The really delightful thing is everybody's genuine interest that we speak to push the ESG agenda. And at the heart of all of this is, you know, can we use these materials in a much better way than landfilling, you know? And even in my own, you know, your own private world, you know, if our kettle went wrong as a young lad, Dad would go and buy another filament and we'd use the same carcass. Today, you know, us and our generations underneath us, we're encouraged to put it straight into a rubbish bin of some description, and it's then a lottery as to whether those materials are saved. So, you know, it has to be right, doesn't it, that we're all working to really use these commodities more than once, and hopefully lots more than once, and really use them in a genuine way to strip back this greenwash rhetoric. The greenwash rhetoric is disappearing a bit, but you still don't see enough companies trying to be genuine with it. And that's the thing that we're finding, is that because we're so close to going live with these projects, those that are genuine about ESG for their corporations are really engaged with us. And it's it's great to be this side of the table, Kevin. It really is.
So the exciting part of this announcement that happened this week for me was that surely pretty much every council or metropolitan area within the UK is going to need one of these lithium dustbin producers of black mass. So the potential for that business has got to be huge.
It has, Kevin, and I think what it might do from a political point of view is that we can, with this mobile unit, actually offer every council a common solution. Because one of the slight frustrations that national agencies have is that local councils will try their own individual systems. So in Norfolk, for example, where I live, last week we had a, you know, if you've got anything with a battery in, pop it in a little bag and we're trialing you putting it on top of your green bin. Yeah, don't give us too much to start off with. But then when you speak to the national agency, they're going, oh my goodness me, you know, that council's doing one thing, the council in the neighbouring county is doing something different. So by us having these vehicles, I'm hoping that it will actually give a common solution for the whole of the UK to offer this doorstep collection system that will encourage everybody to try and reuse these materials.
Great. Coming back to our circle, and we have the four sections. Currently, I think each one of those could be worth your current market capitalization, which is £16 million. You probably can't answer that question, but right now, effectively, the market is valuing each one of those sections at approximately £4 million. So, Robin, why do you think that is right now?
My answer to you, Kevin, is this, that, you know, we've been in an extremely challenging period as a business in that we've had this uncertainty around the license and the timing of the licenses. And as business people, we've had to have this fine juggling, commercial juggling situation of we've had to retain enough competency in the business to be able to be compliant with legislation and to win awards like this Innovate grant. You've got to have a certain competency level within the business. And we got all of our three key ISO standards through as well during this holding period waiting to go live. So we've had this incredibly challenging balance between operational without revenue and competency so that we don't fail with license applications. But of course, we have a burn rate. And part of this burn rate has to be funded from somewhere. And as an exec team, we've been working so hard in the background to make sure that we keep the right level of money coming through the system as best we very can. And, you know, the deal that we've had with the bank, you know, we announced a few weeks ago, has enabled us to carry on doing what we're doing in a short-term period. Now we've got some new investment into the business, as we've described, and that new investment means now that we're able to transition from that bank facility to actually having cash in the system to not have to borrow money in that way from the banking sector. So as all of those monies transition out, in my opinion, I think they are the reason why we've had this glass ceiling on our share price. And I think now that we are in a position where we've cleared that hurdle with this new injection of cash, that glass ceiling, we are expecting that glass ceiling to go. And as soon as we're able to release the news then that we've got the license, I think that then will push us even further through that glass ceiling.
Hopefully that will be the big catalyst to moving the company back to, you know, even the valuation it had back in November 21 when you obviously were, you know, your first day of dealings on the market. So we wish you all the best, you know, going forward, and we look forward to welcoming you back onto the podcast when you've got obviously the next piece of news out there. And just say thank you, Robin, thank you, Lester, and thank you, Alex, for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, so it's always good to catch up with the Tech Minerals guys, and it's quite nice to see the three of them together, isn't it? And then we can look at the whole of their portfolio of assets.
Yeah. I mean, just reiterate what was said. I mean, the company is, to me, vastly undervalued. And yeah, we'll see what happens over the coming months as the EA approval comes in. And then, you know, revenue will commence in a big way. But also the revenue is going to be increasing now for the lead acid batteries as well. So, yeah,
very good.
That's very encouraging.
So what else has been on the radar? Any significant news items this week you've got?
Yeah, we had a few different bits of news, didn't we? On Friday, we had Chilbrands come in with an announcement saying the initial purchase order for its nicotine-free vapor products has been received from a new distributor operating in Florida and the surrounding states. So you wouldn't think that's insignificant because it's like a distributor that's going to be giving them out to many stores by the looks of things. Products marketed as Chill Zero are under consideration by numerous retail buyers, representing some of the largest convenience store chains in the United States. So, again, that sounds rather promising, doesn't it? The company is also taking steps to enable online sales of its vapor products via the chill.com website, having procured a number of relationships with specialist carriers. So, yeah, I mean, basically it's moving forward, isn't it? It's cashed up from the previous raise of, what was it, £560,000. Really nothing should be stopping this now. It should just hopefully start to build on revenues. You would imagine going into this vape area, I don't know about you, Phil, but I think it's going to be exponential growth. I don't see how it'd be anything different, really, to be honest.
No, I think it's, and the share price is reflecting it, isn't it? Now it's starting to garner a bit more interest. I think it closed the day around, was about 4.3 on Friday, wasn't it, around that mark? And it's had a good run of late as well. So, yeah, let's hope it continues to re-rate. The other one that was on that had some news this week was BSF Enterprise. They have an oversubscribed £2.9 million fundraise. They raised at 17 pence per share. That was very exciting, wasn't it? I thought that was. I mean, there's obviously a lot of talk about that bulletin board sort of last 2 months, but they finally got it away, and it was, as I say, the fact it was oversubscribed, always exciting, especially in a market like this.
Yeah, and you probably look at 30-day VWAP on that share, and it's probably not much more than 17p. I know it was up at 20 and 21, but it was also down at 15 and 14 at during that period. So, 17p with half warrants at 34p, I think tells its story. I think they've got an exciting number of months ahead of them. And
they've got a lot there, yeah. I mean, in the RNS, they talked about the use of the placing proceeds. Obviously, they're going to continue development of the company's cultivated meat fillets. They've got the ongoing expansion of the City Mix production capacity, serving new global target markets, further development of the 3D BioTissues lab-grown leather products, and the advancement of 3D BioTissues cornea proposition. Obviously, we talked about that on previous podcasts, finalizing the process for full thickness cornea production. So very exciting. They've got a lot of different areas they're working with there, aren't they?
Yeah. And thinking of looking at bargain of the week share, and a share that actually at the minute I just feel is just massively oversold, and one which I think has the opportunity to bounce. And this week I'm going to say that it's Genflow Bioscience at 165. Market capitalization of very little, basically. Market capitalization of 4.75 million has probably at least half of that potentially in cash. 70% of everything that they're doing in R&D is being paid by the European Union. And this therapy could change all of our lives, you know, to sort of give us a better time later in life and possibly extend our lives. But more importantly, that our lives will be better in the later years. So I really think when you look at some of the other companies, I think it's Altos Labs in the US, and who are all trying to do this same thing, they're worth hundreds of millions, if not billions.
Yeah.
And here we are, somebody with technology that's going to be going into human trials within a period of time, and it's worth £5 million. Just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's so. And they've got about 2.5 years of runway, haven't they? In terms of, obviously, they've got the EU grants there. They've got the money they've raised. And Eric, we know we've had Eric on a couple of times, and he runs the business, you know, not on a shoestring, but you know, he's very careful with his money, isn't he? He knows what to do. He's got, you know, and he's got so much passion about that. I mean, I think you talked to him for about 45 minutes last time, didn't you? Went on.
Yeah.
He could talk for hours about it, couldn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's my new set, bargain of the week. Bargain of the week is Genflow.
Genflow's good. But the other one that moved was Celadon. Yeah, obviously, Jim Short we had on a couple of weeks ago now. In fact, he was on Mother's Day Sunday roast. So it was interesting. The listening figures were slightly down on the normal, probably because most people were sat around a nice roast meal with their mothers and families. So well worth a listen if you haven't heard that one. We'll post it up on Twitter and on the various social media sites. But that move from, it dropped back, didn't it, to around about the 118, 120 mark, maybe even lower, 108. And then it had a really good week this week. It went up to 184 and finished the day on Friday at 155, 160. Looks very good. I think just people starting to really appreciate just, you know, how big this company could be going forward. So, yeah, have a listen. What are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, no, I mean, it has the potential to exponentially grow because the demand is there. So, yeah, I think it's great. We also met the guy from Sizzle Biotech as well when we were in London, didn't we?
Yeah,
Alan Sims. Had a quick drink with him, Alan Sims. So, yeah, and Alan, very knowledgeable guy. And, yeah, he wanted to talk chemistry and talk all about the product and what he's trying to create and what they've created and how they created it. Yeah, while we were with him, so it was good. Yeah. good to catch up with them.
Some of the shakers this week, unfortunately, there was Vasarian, you know, the graphene focus group. They've now lost 96% of their value over the last 5 years, basically, which is just they've been utterly crushed. They have released an AGM statement this week. They had the AGM in London. Graphene Focus Group said it was experiencing challenging market conditions and will have to raise further funding to achieve their goals. So that one was hammered down. I think the market cap's about 6 million now. They've got that, obviously, that collaboration with Umbro, you know, the sportswear manufacturer. So that one's been absolutely hammered. And there's been a lot of tweets around that as well. And I think that Ricketts, their CEO, has been taking a lot of stick on Twitter, unfortunately, for that one, which is, you know, is not nice to see. But keep an eye on that one. I don't know how they're going to fund things going forward, but I certainly hope that they can turn that, you can turn that company around, because I say it's been absolutely crushed. Premier African Minerals, PREM, is the ticker. Share price around the penny mark. I think they've done something like 20x, or I know they've definitely done 10, but certainly from the real lows, they've really done well over the last probably year. Market cap around the 200 million mark. They've completed construction of the new plant at their Zulu Lithium and Tantalum project. Following the completion of the plant, the company said that they're expected to begin spodumene production this week. In addition, the Premier African Minerals said that they had received interest from third parties in relation to offtake agreements and equity investment into Zulu. So that's been a great performer over the last year, as I say, Kev.
Yeah, and more general, we've seen the FTSE start to recover again. You know, it went down to 7.2 something, and now it's in the 7.6s. I've seen also gold went back down again and it's coming back up. 1970 or something, I think it is now, towards the $2,000 mark, which you would have to say seems to be not inevitable, but I think it's coming, you know, under the auspices of just printing more money. Then you have to have a solid asset, has to be worth more, you would imagine. And then something I've been keeping my eye on, which is the S&P VIX, which is basically a measure of volatility. It's been having lower highs, higher lows, so it's sort of on a downward spiral. So what that tends to signify is that volatility is slowly but surely reducing and people are starting to have a bit more confidence in the market.
Yeah.
Just over a week ago, that VIX was nearly at 30 and it's now below 20. It's about 18, I think, at the minute. So above 20, lots and lots of volatility. As it starts to drop, and it looks like it possibly could continue to drop, then you've got a steady state market, then that hopefully people are starting to gain more confidence in what's happening. And maybe it will be then a bit more risk on. And they'll start looking for what we perceive to be the undervalued stocks or the bargains, which we've been saying for probably the last 12 months. Then
No. You've been saying it for the last 24
months. I've been saying it. I'm happy to admit it's me. I am the optimist, but the reality is it is coming.
I mean, the last two or three sessions, I must admit, have given me a bit of hope, I'll be honest. And it's interesting you say that, because if you look at it's been a challenging March for the FTSE. We saw it in sort of February rising into those all-time highs, 8,000. And then it dropped back down to sort of the 7,200 mark, right? Now, it finished March on Friday with gains of around 3% at around 76.31. But interestingly, the point you made is that the FTSE 250 gained a little bit, but the AIM All Share, the small caps, rose 0.4% on Friday. So it actually had a good session. So yeah, I'm definitely seeing a bit more spark, let's say, in the small caps and the nano caps.
Yeah, and it has to come, because effectively there was, there's been a drought. And, you know, we've seen companies and investors start to recognize that with different raises that we've seen. We had one with the Technology Minerals. We had the institutional investor in Chile. We've had BSFA raise 2.9 million. You know, so they wouldn't be getting this money if people didn't have confidence. The markets started to move as well.
Good companies, a good story, are getting good deals.
Yeah, so I'm encouraged, and it will go through the stages of the bull market. Obviously, there'll be a bit of belief and pull back, bit of belief, and then continue to go. And then eventually, within a period of time, we'll have hysteria, you know, as we did before, the casino that was Corona. And, you know, everybody's just piling in. If you got out, you made a load of money. If you didn't and you stayed in, then you lost a lot of money. But bull runs tend to run for years, and I think we're entering a bull run, and well, we will be entering a bull run, and the bull run will be focused around the resource sector, in my view.
Well, anything else? I mean, I think we've wrapped up the markets there. The Man City are playing this week against an average team with no trophies in the cabinet this season, just a can of 7-Up to show for it, apparently.
Yeah, so let's hope we do Arsenal a favour and ourselves a favour.
Good luck with that one. And then United play Newcastle.
Yeah, that's not an easy one either. Newcastle are on the up.
Yep.
Not sure who will want to win that one. So there you go. And then we've got the breakaway golf this weekend as well. We've got LIV Golf going on this weekend. And then next weekend, we've got the Masters with all the LIV golfers who have already qualified. I think that's 18 of them. So, yeah, I'm watching LIV Golf. I mean, I know you're not a golfer, but as a golf fan, the LIV Golf and the Greg Norman thing, I found it very entertaining. It's a very quick way of watching a golf tournament because it lasts maybe 4.5 hours and you've seen every player and you've seen all of the rounds. So, and the team thing in it is very good, like the Ryder Cup type of thing. So
I like the Ryder thing. I think it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. It's fascinating.
Yeah, no, but this whole team thing is good. It's nowhere near what the Ryder Cup is because obviously it's a different format, but it makes it interesting and it makes all the players play to their potential when they're in the second, third round, even if they're not going to win the tournament. So yeah, all good.
Got the Australian Grand Prix as well on Sunday, so that on today, so that should be good. All right, well, good. On that note, I'll we say thanks for listening. Remember, we're taking a break, a well-earned break for 2 to 3 weeks, so we'll come back after Easter.
But you will still hear Midweek Roasts on a regular basis. Again, I say to you, we've got the YouTube channel.
Hit like, subscribe, and hit the bell icon, and you will receive all the future notifications for any future podcasts. Thanks for listening, and have a great Easter, and we'll be back in a few weeks.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.